you're happy, 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 clap your hands.
If it makes you happy,
tiny happy people,
bring me down, kingdom.
So happy together.
Don't worry, be happy.
Delivering Happiness, in conjunction with the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, presents Culture Champion Radio. Now here's your host, Brad Wolf.
Okay, and welcome to the Delivering Happiness Culture Champion Podcast. My name is Brad Wolf. I am here with the lovely Golby Kamarai at BlackRock Financial. Cannot be happier to be here with you, Golby. Good
too,
to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
We're already having a great time and we haven't even started the podcast yet, which is going to, you know, that's a precursor of what is to come out there. So get ready for a good one here. So Golby is the global program manager for BlackRock's Global Client and Sales Excellence Program. And did I mention, by the way, that BlackRock is perhaps the number one most influential financial services company in the entire world, or so says a quote on Wikipedia that I read earlier today. So, wow, there's a lot of assets in this building and around the world that you guys control.
That's right.
So you make a huge impact in the world in so many different ways in the financial world. But today, of course, we're going to be talking about how you're able to do that here vis-a-vis culture. How does culture play an important part? And, you know, when a lot of people think about the financial world, they don't really think of positive cultures. Mm. And so I think what a lot of people are going to be interested to learn is how have you made an impact? Because as we're going to describe, you are a culture champion. And so how did we bestow that upon you? What have you done here? And what has been started here to account for this title that we are knighting you with?
I'm guessing you're alluding to the fact that I started the BlackRock Meditation Program.
That is right. So Golby, which is really amazing here, and did I also mention, no, I did not, but she is a speaker. She was recently a speaker at the Wisdom 2.0 conference. What city was that in?
That was in New York.
The Business Wisdom 2.0
That's
conference.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So people are already asking Golby across the world now to speak on this topic, and we're so lucky to have her because, as she was mentioning, she has created this mindfulness and meditation training program here, which has reached over 1,300 employees in 17 countries. And she leads this meditation twice a week and conducts workshops that later on in the podcast, we might even have her demonstrate what that actually looks like. So stay tuned after we get through some of this, the formalities of learning the what's behind what she did. So how are you doing today, Golby?
I'm doing well. How are you, Brad?
Very well. Before we start, a couple things. I just want to say thank you and hand you this.
Thank you. This is called
you can shake it. That's a wow bell.
Okay, thank you.
All right, that's a wow bell from Delivering Happiness and a little bracelet if you ever if you wear bracelets. Yes.
I will wear one right now.
Sweet. And then something else we like to ask just to kind of warm up, because Delivering Happiness, one thing we believe in is being true to your weird self. And I know we might talk about authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
What is something weird that makes you happy?
Something weird that makes me happy about the universe or about other people? Or
anything
about
that comes to mind. You can take a second if you want to think about it.
Take a second.
I can fill in this gap while you're thinking and say, you know, I think whales make me happy. The fact that they spout that water out of their blowhole, that's weird.
I guess that's weird. Oh, gosh. Well, now that we've opened up this box, there's a lot of things that make me happy. I don't know if this is really weird, but one of the things that just makes my heart fill and I get so happy is when I see a little kid reach up to hold an adult's hand. And so like they just, it's, I love it. It gets me every time. So if I happen to be walking behind someone, and the little kid just, you know, reaches up.
I feel like what you said was a lot better than what I said.
I don't know. Whales spout in water. That works too.
All right. They also jump high and make big splashes. I don't know. They're neat. I've seen them in Alaska. All right, moving on. So I think what's really interesting about what you've done is there is this idea of Delivering Happiness we talk about being able to bring your full self to work. And and how the same things that make an individual happy are the same things that are necessary to make a company happy. And you have to merge this idea of the me and the we. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what you've done, being able to create this program, seems to be, in essence, what I'm talking about. So maybe tell me a little bit about your background in both the finance world, mm-hmm, and this meditation world, and how you've been able to kind of merge these two things.
Sure. So my background in the finance world, so I studied psychology as my undergrad. So I've always been interested in human behavior and how the human mind works. And I didn't go into psychology straight away. I had thought about it. I didn't know if I wanted to be doing organizational behavior or go into clinical psych. And so I chose neither because I couldn't decide. And I went into real estate development. And through real estate development, I found my way into real estate finance, which is how I started with BlackRock. And then did that for 4 years, and then moved over to help start something called the BlackRock Investment Institute, which I did for 3 years. And then just a couple months ago, moved over to this new role. So I've found my way into an organizational development, organizational behavior type role through a circuitous route. But I've always been interested in how people show up at work and how people engage. And about 3 years ago, I guess in December of 2011, on a whim, I decided to go to a yoga ashram, not really thinking much of it, thinking it would be fun and it would just mostly be yoga. And it was at an ashram that I didn't know how to find an ashram at that point. So I went on TripAdvisor.
What is an ashram?
Can be defined differently, but in many ways it can be a spiritual type of place. So sometimes some ashrams practice yoga, some are for meditation. They're various ashrams of different lineages, schools of thought. So I found one on TripAdvisor, which when I told some of my very practiced meditation friends that, they all got a really good chuckle out of it. It ended up being a very legitimate organization. And I went for 5 days, and that's where I was introduced to meditation. And the experience changed my life, completely changed my life. I'd always understood the mind and understood myself really through a Western lens. And this was my first introduction to an Eastern philosophy or a more Buddhist psychology. And it felt like it completed so much of what I was seeking and what I was looking to find. And so I really just dug into it. And for 3 years since then, I've spent nearly every vacation or every long weekend at an ashram or taking a workshop or somehow diving into the practice of meditation and or yoga. And it's had such an impact on my life that all my friends and colleagues at work would know I would go on these trips. And so whenever I would come back to work, they would always ask me about, well, Golbs, what'd you learn this time? What'd you learn this time? And so I would start to translate it in the language that worked for them and made sense to them. And that was really the beginning of what became the BlackRock Meditation Program.
So maybe just very briefly, explain what BlackRock does. Mm-hmm.
So BlackRock is an asset manager. So we invest money for our clients, and our clients range from sovereign wealth funds and corporate pensions all the way down to you and I and our 401k. We have 4.32, I think is the most recent number, trillion dollars assets under management, and we have about 11,000 employees around the world in 30 different countries. And so we invest, so we have mutual funds, and we have ETFs. We invest active management, and we also have passive management investments.
So, I mean, it strikes me, from an outsider's perspective, that if you're managing tons and tons of money, you have to be pretty careful.
You do. Yes, you have to be very diligent.
Right. And so I think what I'm hoping that people get out there is that if you can, in this industry, if you can make these kinds of changes that we're going to describe in this industry, I feel like the lessons that we can discuss that maybe come out of your example could be applied really anywhere.
I think so. I mean, ultimately, we're going to talk about culture change. We're also going to talk about meditation and mindfulness. But all of those have the common root of we're talking about people and we're talking about humanity. And it doesn't matter if you're doing finance or if you're in the legal profession or if you're in technology. Ultimately, as far as people are concerned, there's a way to relate any practice so that it resonates.
So maybe you could describe for us, what is this BlackRock meditation program and how specifically does it work?
Sure. So the program started in April of 2013, again, on the heels of me coming back from a recent vacation and thinking, well, I should just start this at BlackRock. I've lead meditations for my friends. They seem to have a lot of impact. Let me see what happens. And I had been working in the New York City office at the time. So we sent an email to the New York City office, which was about 2,500 people, inviting them to come to a weekly guided meditation. Instantly, 65 people showed up, and they joined. 35 joined the session the next week, and the rest is history. It grew through word of mouth. And so what is it? It has five components, really four, and the fifth one is what we're building towards. So the first component is weekly guided meditations, which I run out of whatever office I happen to be in. So I was in New York for many years, and I would host them there. And then I've recently relocated to San Francisco. But if I happened to be traveling to London, I would host them out of
How do you host a meditation? Can everyone fit in your office?
Right. So we have conference rooms around the world. So I don't know if I said this. There are 1,300 people in 30 different cities that have opted into the program. And,
wow.
And so we have conference rooms in nearly all those cities that where the time zone makes sense. So I would host it at 8 a.m. New York City time. And for our Asia colleagues, our India colleagues, it makes sense. So India dials in. But some of our other Asian colleagues, that time doesn't make sense. So the east side of the country, of U.S., would dial in, as would EMEA. And we'd have conference rooms everywhere. People could show up in person, or if they were at home or at their desk, they could dial in at that time. So there's a global dial-in, and it's always half an hour. And everyone, the sense of community is hugely important to me. So we always start off by taking a minute just to introduce yourself to the people to your left and right. And then I might give an introduction, or I might say, give some sort of anecdote about what we're going to do or how the practice has impacted me. Then we'll do practice for about 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll wrap it up. And I might give some sort of takeaway or something people might want to consider before the next session.
Man, I'm so excited to do this in a few minutes.
But that's actually just one bit of it. That's
okay.
The one that people know the most.
Okay.
I don't have to go into too much detail, but I will say the other part that people know is I send regular emails to the entire community. So in any one of those given sessions, it might be 20 people joining in, depending on what's going on in their jobs or in the markets at that time or, you know, life. Or it might be we've had as many as 150 or 200 at times. So it really depends. But because we want to reach more than just the people who can leave their desk or dial in at that time, I send regular emails. And those emails have tips and articles and resources and maybe videos, a summary of what we practice, so that everyone can get a sense of, feel like they're part of a community and they can learn something. And then we'll do workshops. I'll do workshops at some of our leadership offsites, introducing the concept to various leaders around the firm. We'll bring in guest teachers and speakers. So we have, you know, a couple people on tap for next year, which I'm excited about. And then the fifth thing that I'm hoping to do next year, I was hoping to do it this year, but we weren't able to, is really develop a custom course at the firm.
Cool.
Yeah.
So those are the five pillars of this
that
program.
Right.
So it's
yes.
not just the guided meditation. It's really
not.
An entire meditation, mindfulness.
Absolutely.
Movement.
I'm hoping. I mean, it's about offering it to the employees as well as, you know, sharing and translating how it's relevant to our senior leadership so that it really starts to influence the culture.
Right. So speaking of that, how would you say, you know, this fits with the firm's own values and culture?
Yeah. So BlackRock has very strong principles and values. And two of them happens to be around innovation. Believe very strongly in pushing the envelope on trying new things. And a second value or principle, as we call them, that the firm holds to is creating a supportive, inclusive, collaborative culture, which we call One BlackRock. So it doesn't matter what office you're in, what team you're in, or what legacy firm you may have come from, because we've grown a lot through acquisition, we're all part of One BlackRock. And so the program really, it helps foster both of those, innovation and the sense of community and collaboration.
Were you thinking about that when you're trying to communicate? Because a big deal is obviously how do you communicate if you mm-hmm. want to start something, you want to bring your own self to work.
Yeah.
How do you communicate this out or design the program in such a way that other people in your company mm-hmm. embrace it and can make that connection between what you're doing and the values that fit with the firm?
Sure. So I guess a couple things come to mind. So how can people make the connection between what I'm doing and the values? So part of it is just
actually drawing the connection to them. So there's a lot of research and science coming out about meditation and mindfulness, the impact it has on your mind, on your body. There's, you know, links to increasing compassion, increasing creativity. I'm trying to think if I should take a step back. Is that all right?
Sure. Take a big step back.
So one of my, it kind of talks to bringing your whole self to work. One of my foundational beliefs and what I really believe truly is that when people can operate and work in a place of authenticity of themselves and in their culture, they're unstoppable. When their head, their heart, their mind, their body are aligned internally, and that's aligned with the culture and the environment they're in, they are capable of changing the world. They are the ones who have boundless energy. Their creativity goes through the roof. Their productivity goes through the roof. Their ability to collaborate, because they are able just to self-express. And I don't know how many cultures and companies, and you'd probably be in a better place to know this than I, can foster that. That's pretty unique, to create the conditions by which people can show up and be authentic. And my belief is that one of the massive inhibitors of that is stress. And so the reason I'm geared towards meditation and mindfulness is it's one of many tools to help combat stress and deal with stress. Mm-hmm. And in terms of how do I make that relevant for people, I work in a very rationally oriented, linear thinking oriented industry. And so science is deeply valued. And so I will look to the science to tell us about not only how meditation can impact stress, but how it impacts other areas of a person's how the person's well-being. And so, you know, I don't know if you ever took this class at Stanford, but Robert Sapolsky's human behavioral biology.
It's true. We both are graduates of the same fine institution. Go Card. Yeah, but I didn't take his full course, but okay. I did sit in some of his most popular lectures.
So he was remarkable, and so he's a world-renowned stress expert. And so I'll often mention a book that he wrote called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, that talks about the human stress response and how we can mentally keep ourselves or create a sense of fight or flight or anxiety for ourselves, even though there's no present stimulus to warrant that. And so we'll often look to his research. Richie Davidson actually just published an article in Scientific American, which I think is fantastic. So, and I consider him a friend, so I'm happy to plug him and be transparent about plugging him. But
thank you. Yeah. Plug away. I mean, we're plugging stuff that matters here. Yeah. So I think it's not really a plug. It's just sharing, you know, and that's what you're doing. And, you know, it strikes me that especially in an institution like this, and that being able to put science or metrics, I mean, in a world that is so on one side rational, it's neat and seems so important that in the more recent years, we're able to make a cogent argument for why these things are so important, even though at that fundamental level, like, I don't know where your beliefs about this came, if it came from listening to a lecture or there was something in you that kind of sensed this. And it's nice to find the validation in a science for what you already believe.
Absolutely. You know, I think people come to things in various different ways, but there's a host of the population who needs to understand things intellectually before they're willing to experiment emotionally with something or physically, for example. And so, yeah, how do we make it relevant to the values? We use science to get people's attention, to make it, you know, and all the research that we're learning from the field of neuroscience is tremendous. And so that catches people's attention. They appreciate it. And then we make it relevant to the cultural values of the firm and then to the individuals. Cause ultimately we're talking about a very human experience. We're talking about people's experience. And so making this program personal and matter to people, I think is what has gotten people's loyalty.
So maybe you could share some of the, you know, results that you've noticed, or if there's anything you've heard or noticed. I mean, I did happen to see a quote from a fellow employee of Golby's who wrote somewhere, "Phenomenal job in enabling enlightenment of the financial services world, a true pioneer, light worker." So, you know, at least anecdotally, I was able to find some evidence of, you know, not just evidence. I mean, that's talking about enlightenment of the financial services world. That is pretty big statement.
Yeah.
So that's really sweet. But maybe, you know, what have you noticed, or how have you seen this impact the culture, or you know, how is it being received?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. So we have a lot of anecdotal feedback, about 400 different pieces of feedback, because we've been at this for almost 2 years, about a year and a half, 2 years. But we also, I also sent out a survey to try and quantify what the impact has been. And so I can read off some of those numbers, but it's not scientific at this point, but it's all self-reported, but we are looking at better ways to measure the impact. But 91% of the program participants, the people who answered the survey, believe it positively adds to our culture. 88% would recommend the program to a colleague. So it's having impact in that regard. 66% of people say they experience either less stress or they're better able to manage their stress.
Wow.
63% are better able at managing themselves as a whole. 60% noticed increased focus, mental resilience, decision making. 52% are better at managing relationships with peers at work. So it happens in terms of interpersonal dynamic. 46% experienced increased innovation and creativity.
Wow.
And so then we went another step further and said, okay, well, it's great to say that it's had an impact, but can you quantify the impact? And so, again, this is all self-reported, but for example, and I won't go through all the details because there's a lot, but for the people who said that they are more effective or productive at work, I gave them intervals, and 8% of people said that they were greater than 50% more effective or productive at work.
Wow.
For simply participating in the program. And for that might just be knowing that there exists a program and getting regular emails that I might send, or for others it might be, you know, coming and sitting at the practice twice a week.
Can you say that again, the stat?
Sure.
That's like zone in my brain.
Okay, so the people who said that they were more effective or productive at work, I asked for intervals of how much more productive. And at the highest interval, 8% of those people said that they were over 50% more productive.
That is just, so have you shown these results to anyone?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, you know, all the senior leadership at the firm knows that we're doing this. They're very supportive. One of our vice chairs is the executive sponsor. They've seen the data, and that they're giving their support, which is why we're continuing to build it.
Wow. So what was the process? I'm curious, both your process and then maybe if you want to deal with this in two separate questions, or I'd be curious how you actually, the steps you took to build this program,
mm-hmm.
And get it started, how you were able to foster support, how you're able to bring other people into the fold, and how that's helped push the program forward.
Sure.
And kind of simultaneously or after, what advice you have mm-hmm. for other people who would want to start something like this in any context?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So it actually grew really organically. And in this area, I've actually tried to keep it pretty organic. I think that's what organic and authentic. I made two commitments when I started this. One, that I would show up to every session. And until except for when I was on vacation, and until I recently switched jobs and my schedule shifted a bit, I only missed 3 sessions in a year and a half.
And how many, you did a session a week?
1 session a week for the first few months and then 2 sessions a week. So if it was 5 a.m. in San Francisco and I was on a business trip, I called in at 5 a.m. Or if it was 9:30 p.m. And I was in a hotel room in London, I called in at 9:30 p.m. So one of my strong commitments is if this is going to work, there needs to be a sense of ownership and commitment. So that, and then the second commitment I made when I first started was to be really authentic and transparent about my own journey, and know that I'm learning all the time. You know, I haven't asserted that I'm someone other than I'm not. I haven't lived in a monastery or practiced meditation for years. I don't have 10,000 years of experience, but I have been practicing it for 3 years, and I'm an avid student, and I have tried to be really transparent about what I'm learning, what's working for me, what's not working for me, so that people feel comfortable. So in that vein of being authentic, I've kept this organic in terms of how it unfolds.
So just one question on this point of sure. authenticity, and in terms of communicating that to others, mm-hmm. like you're just mentioning, how do you do that? I mean, I think at one point you mentioned to me that in the meditations themselves, they maybe have a flavor that relates to the workplace in some context.
Yeah.
And that, to me, I'd like you to maybe explain what you meant by that, because to me that seems really interesting. I mean, when I think of meditation, you know, you might think of, you wouldn't think of any images or things that connote work or... So maybe you can just expand on the question I'm asking.
Sure. I think I understand it. So I'll give it a go. And if I don't,
sure.
Let me know. And then we can come back to the other question if you want to finish that one.
Oh, I do.
okay. So in the meditation, so one example of trying to be authentic and trying to make this relate to people. So not everyone, when you tell someone something, they don't necessarily make the connection of how it relates to them or how it relates to what, you know, work, for example. And so I will sometimes give a story about something that's happened in the work world and or in my own personal experience. And I will I'll talk about how my meditation practice might have helped me realize something. So I'll give an example. So I
please do.
All right. So I sent an email to, gosh, I think it was, 1,200 people at the time or 13, maybe it was the entire community. So 1,000, if not hundreds of people. And I reread it after I sent it, and I realized that I had made a typo, and it was a silly typo. And in the grand scheme of things, that's not a big deal. But, you know, I was frustrated because I had wanted to write a really thoughtful email, and I had this typo. And I'd been thinking about it, and I caught myself. I was on my way home, and I caught myself thinking about it. And I really just stopped literally on the way to my apartment. I said, Golby, that's not happening in the here and now. It already happened. There's nothing you can do to change it. Notice the fact that your mind's wandering. Let go of what it's wandering to and just come back to what's happening now. And what was happening now was I was walking home. And so in that, I might share an example like that. And so that helps people see of, oh, I get it. I know I can understand how to relate to it. Or there's a theme here with my examples of not being able to stop thinking about work. But I was leaving work one day and I was still thinking about it. And it was late in the evening and I was standing on a New York City subway. And I remember I was checking my work BlackBerry and my personal phone as well. And I was just kind of replaying all these things I had done for the day and what I had to do next week or the next day. And I remember thinking, no, I need to be here. This is my life is only lived in the present moment. I need to be here. And so I thought, okay, well, how do I transition to being here? Because I was really amped and my mind was going a million miles an hour. And so I said, all right, well, let me look around and start noticing all the colors. And so I said, can I notice all the red? So I looked around in the subway and I noticed all the little bits of red. And then I said, okay, now all the green and all the little bits of green. And then I went through all the colors until I started to feel like my body was starting to slow down and calm down and my mind was slowly starting to settle. And so I'll give examples like that of when we find ourselves in these situations throughout the day where, you go to a meeting and your mind can't let go of what happened in the meeting, but there's still work to do. You don't want to be there all night. So you have to let go of what's already happened and be present. What are the tips or techniques or how can you use the practice to be fully engaged in what it is you're doing?
All right. Well, that is great. So it seems like the first tenet of what you're describing in terms of the process of creating this program was being authentic.
Mm-hmm.
When you say organic, it's coming from your own experience and really being, practicing what you preach.
Mm-hmm.
By being mindful and trying to be mindful in your creation of a mindful practice.
Yeah. Well said.
Which is, kind of when you talk about the internal fit of a company, it's the very mm-hmm. parallel. It's like you the culture of a company needs to embody what the company does. So if you're talking like Southwest Airlines, they're talking about freedom, how do they then embed freedom into their culture?
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, what you're talking about, it's like you were able to embed mindfulness into mm-hmm. your creation of mindfulness. So I think it's pretty neat. So, okay. So carry on then with how you created the program, given the first step was just this organic growth and thinking about it, in this organic, but mindful way.
Okay. The goal and the aspiration at the beginning was really just to help one person. The practice changed my life. And I thought if I can help create the conditions to change one other person's life, that will be enough. And so it really started with sending an email to, I'd been the vice chair of our people and culture committee. So we have culture committees in every office. And so I had been the vice chair of the New York City culture committee. So through that organization, sent an email and got a bunch of people in the New York City office to sign up, or they signed up, and then we had the first session. And then it really grew through word of mouth. And so we booked conference rooms, we told people about it, and then other people were starting to share their experiences. of not only what the practice, the impact of the practice, but the impact of being part of a community or a culture where authenticity was valued.
Well, I just have to interrupt because I think what people would be really curious about is, first of all, you have a culture committee in each of these offices. So maybe you could just give a little bit of background on what is this culture committee and how do you get to be on it? And what is that about?
Sure. So BlackRock takes culture really seriously. We're a founder-led organization, and we, you know, from the people who come from other companies, I've learned that we really are a very unique culture, which is great. It's great to be part of that. And so in an effort to support that and encourage that, the various leadership teams have supported the creation of people and culture committees. And so each office has one. And I think the way you get on it is you're one of the leaders of one of our other employee networks. So we have about 5 or 6 employee networks. And I happened to be at that time the vice chair of our women's network in New York City.
You go, girl.
And so I think that's how I originally got on and then, you know, took on a role, a leadership role with people and culture. It might have shifted now. That was a few years ago. But the goal is really, how do we help everyone in that office? And this is, again, these people and culture committees are more regionally based. But how do we help every employee in this office feel connected, feel like they're part of BlackRock? How do we connect them to the other employee networks? How do we create an environment that that's conducive to, you know, the values and the principles of the company?
But I'm sure something like mindfulness meditation still strikes, you know, might strike people as kind of frou-frou.
That's right. Yes, that does happen sometimes.
And so I think that will brings us back to then how you were looking. So you have this culture, you know, you're on the culture committee.
Yeah,
so
that's how it got launched. But so here's the thing. Here's how I think about it. It really, culture change needs to take both bottom up change and also top down change. And so by introducing the meditation program to the community of BlackRock, people started to join and they would tell their friends and colleagues about it. And we started to grow this employee base to now the point where it's 12% of the firm. And so some of those people were senior leaders, our most senior leaders, and some of them were had less seniority in the firm. And yet they were influenced on a personal level. As it started to become this wave in the firm and people were talking about it because I guess they were interested in it or it was having impact, we started to talk a little bit more that's when we got an executive sponsor. That's when I started to talk to more leadership about the impact of the program, what the results were. And we're starting to explore ways to connect it to how the firm engages or how various leaders lead. So I've been invited, I guess, at this point, maybe to three or four leadership offsites that various people will hold for their own teams. And they will bring in various speakers. And so I might talk about authenticity. I might talk about mindfulness. I might talk about how it impacts our culture at the firm. And since I've been here almost, you know, 7.5, 8 years, I know the culture and I know a lot of these people. So I can speak to it from a place of experience, not observation, which I think makes a difference. And so we've started to, you know, it may have started as a one-person show, but it's no means now that there are 50 volunteers around the world. Whoa. In each of these location offices who help book conference rooms.
Sorry, I had to ring the well bill for that one.
I was being so careful not to like knock it and make sound. But yeah, so it's a team effort. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about was, you mentioned was Wisdom 2.0, but one of the things that I had talked about there was, you know, what are the lessons learned? How do you create change, whether it's culture change or start a meditation program? And it's really that one of the points was one person can change an organization. No doubt. I mean, that's what leadership is. And at the same time, no lasting change is ever done alone. It just isn't. You can't. And so if this was just me, it would have fallen flat on its face. It is the people and the employees at BlackRock. It is the people who have the ideas to, you know, let's add this. Let's bring this person in. Let's do that. And so we really have created something together.
But so in the early days, though, when before you had an executive sponsor and you still had a lot of people participating, how were you able to communicate to the rest of the company what you were doing, or in the beginning of, you know, when you just started, you sent an email to someone down the hall, or like?
Fair enough. Okay, so I think I understand. And yes, people would send emails down the hall. So people would hear about it, you know, through the grapevine, and send me an email and say, "Gulps, what is this thing? Is this real?" And I said, "Yeah, let me add you to a distribution list." So we started in New York, it spread to Princeton, London, San Francisco, various other offices. And we created a distribution list in each location. So I was quite deliberate to keep them separate in case that office wanted to do their own events, or they, you know, wanted to communicate as an office and as a team. We'd invite entire offices to the program at the time. So when we rolled out in our London office, for example, the equivalent of the London People and Culture Committee would send a note saying, you know, please feel free to join guided meditations twice a week or once a week. And so that would be the introduction. And in some instances, we would just send an email to the entire office. People would join that local distribution list. They would find out, they would get calendar invites twice a week from one of my partners who manages the logistics and is a rock star. Thank you, Alyssa. and then they would be in the loop and they'd be in the community. And as we started to get critical mass, we have an intranet. And so there was an article written about the meditation program on our global intranet. And it became one of the highest read articles of this year. Because I think everyone was curious. I don't think it made sense to them. And that was also creating awareness. So now many people know about it. And at least 12% of them are members.
Wow. Okay. So in terms of advice then, I mean, you had some points of wisdom 2.0 that seemed maybe they'd be applicable here, or specific, tangible, concrete advice for how to start culture change or meditation. I mean, Just riff. I mean, you're a jazz influenced culture change champion.
That's hilarious. Okay, so right. So I did make some similar points at Wisdom 2.0, and I realized that whether you're starting a meditation program or it's around culture change, they do apply, and you can. I hope they apply. They're my thoughts, so I'm biased. But the first point was really something related to something you said earlier, which is that organizations support that which supports the organization. So ultimately, we serve our organizations and we're part of it. And so in order to make it relevant, in order to get support, you have to know what's important to your company. What are the needs of your company? What are the values? What are the priorities? What are the principles? And if you can understand that and you can speak that language, then you can translate any idea you might have into becoming relevant to the needs and the values of that organization.
So that seems extremely valuable. I think it seems like great advice that if you're going to make culture change, I mean, this is just hitting me now, you know, you need to use the language of that your company is already speaking.
Absolutely.
Otherwise you're going to seem like an outsider.
Absolutely. So I don't om about meditation. I don't use the language that I might hear if I go to an ashram or I go to a meditation workshop or if I go to a yoga class even. I use the language of a high performance work environment.
Of the culture.
And that's how people who might go, "Oh, that's all hippie stuff. It doesn't really make sense to me," go, "Oh, I get that. That totally makes sense to me. My mind wanders 47% of the time. Okay. I'm more productive if I can regulate my body system so I don't feel a hyper stress response. Got it." So, you know, so it might give a different vibe. But it's organizations support that which support the organization.
Okay, love that point.
Okay, second point, which I already kind of mentioned, which is when I think of culture change, I think is one person can change an organization, but lasting change never happens alone. And I think, you know, with this whole wave of mindfulness, I think it's fantastic. I think it's beautiful. I think what is really going to be the game changer is lasting change. You can go to a workshop, you can take an MBSR course, and those are tremendous. How do you continue that so that it actually isn't just an event, an episodic event? So the third point is, this is particular to meditation and mindfulness. At first thought, maybe it's more broad, but it's that individuals have their own motivations for coming or not coming to the practice of meditation. And so design the program accordingly. And I think the most important part is leave room for all voices and opinions. So if people are hesitant about meditation or mindfulness in a work context. I'm so curious to learn why. And it's not wrong. And the way that BlackRock's dealt with it is there's no one right way to meditate. There's no particular style that's better than the others. They have different impact, and individuals have different motivations for trying it. And so what we've been really deliberate about doing is saying, hey, we're going to introduce you to a lot of different styles. We're going to bring in teachers from lots of different backgrounds. I'm going to send you articles and direct you to books that give you a lot of different lenses on this practice and how it's relevant. It's up for you to decide. It's not for me, it's not for the firm to tell you what's what, right or wrong. It's about giving you a platform for which you can make your own choices. And so that's consistent with BlackRock's culture. There's no one right way to invest. If you can active mutual funds, you can invest in ETFs. There's no right way. And so in that regard, it's important for people to recognize that individuals are motivated by different things. And so to leave room for everyone, even those who don't necessarily, they're not there yet. I think that's hugely informative and empowering. Mm-hmm. There are two more. The fourth one is that passion is essential. It's necessary. It's critical. You need it. It's not sufficient. You also need results. And so results will look different depending on what industry you're in, what organization you're in. At first, the results of the meditation program were around these anecdotes saying, oh, okay, well, this person said it had this impact on their ability to focus or their ability to partner with someone. But then we moved it over to taking more quantitative results.
How did you use the anecdotes at first? Because I think that's a big thing. At first, before you can get some quantifiable results, mm-hmm. how can you strategically use qualitative information?
Yeah, mostly it would be just, again, it was a bit more organic. It was more cool. Look what this person said. You know, can you believe it? And then sometimes if I was sitting down with a more senior person at the firm who is kind of like, tell me what you're doing and what you and your team are doing. And then I might bring some of the quotes and say, okay, it might not seem like, you know, you might not be able to visualize the impact, but this is what, you know, here are four quotes about the impact it's had on someone's ability to be more productive or the impact it's having on people's health and well-being. I would reference results that other companies were having. You know, Aetna quite popularly quite publicly has articulated the impact it's had on their employee population in terms of lowering the healthcare costs mm-hmm. Of their employees, of reducing their stress in material ways, of increasing their productivity. And so they are really vocal about that. So I'll say, look at the impact there. They've studied it in a way that we aren't yet set up to do. And then the fifth point, so organizations support that which support the organization. One person can change an organization, but no lasting change ever happens alone. Individuals have their own motivations. Passion is essential but not sufficient.
Ba-da-ba.
The fifth one is start with the why and the how will come. So I believe mission-driven work is, it will figure out a way. For me, it was to help one person. That's how it started. You know, it's slowly evolved into helping maybe shift the conditions and the culture of an industry.
That is really an incredible thing to say, especially when you think about where this industry has been. So continue. I just it's like, you know, get a sense of I'm in the presence of a real culture champion.
Very kind. But you know, you find a way. No two companies are the same. No two people are the same. And so if you know why something's important to you and that why matters, then you'll do whatever it takes, even if there are roadblocks, even if there are challenges, you'll find a way. And I think passion, again, they're inherent. If you have the passion, then usually the why is pretty strong. But if you can be clear about that why and you can articulate that why, that's usually when other people can come on board and they get really passionate as well. So start with the why, the how will come. You don't always need to know the next step. Sometimes if you're just where you are and you're doing it with authenticity, you're where you are with mindfulness or presence and an authentic desire to have impact, sometimes that's enough. And then the next step will reveal itself.
So I think we're about to have you try to do a guided meditation. I think we should do that.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
Just thinking if there's any, is there anything else you want to share though, before we do, any other you know, practical advice you'd like to give to other culture champions out there, whether it's about starting a program specifically like this in their organization? I mean, maybe given that you started it so organically, and you know, as you just described, you follow the why, and the how starts emerging. But now you have a sense of mm-hmm. the how a little better, mm-hmm. a bit better. And if you were to do it over again, I mean, maybe you would have followed the exact same process. But do you think you could just set up a program like this? You know, if I said, you know, Golby, I'm going to hire you away from BlackRock. Good luck to set up a meditation program. I mean, do you have a sense of how you could do that effectively in another organization, mm-hmm. or is it very so particular to every place that it would, like, what steps would you take to try to answer a question like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think every company has their own culture, and so it starts by knowing that culture well. And I was very privileged to have been here for, I can't have to do some quick math, many years before I started it. And so I had a sense of what BlackRock culture was, and I've worked in different teams around the mm-hmm. firm. So one bit of advice that I have, and I was talking to someone asked me this question, specifically around starting a meditation program at another bank, and gave me a few different outcomes or a few different approaches they might take. And my initial read was, look, culture change is not easy. Behavior change is one of the hardest things to do, whether it's an individual or a group of people. That's why there's so many people out there with different perspectives on how to do it. And that's why lasting change, there's a point, I made the specific point about lasting change, because a lasting behavioral change or culture change is challenging. But to that end, I think you can't necessarily hire someone who has no concept or really strong understanding of that culture per se. You need some sort of internal champion. You need someone that lives and breathes the culture. I mean, this isn't my full-time gig, so I have another job, and so people see me in that job as well. And so they can see me practicing my meditation and my mindfulness practice and how it comes to work. And I think that makes it easier for them to relate to it. So with culture change, it's helpful when, you know, the person that's leading the initiative is just like everyone else. I think that gives it a sense of, okay, well, I could be that person. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. And with that said, so before I do this, how can people find you on Twitter? Do you have are you on the Twitter? You're not on the Twitter. It's okay. I see her. She sees Golby's face.
Sorry, Twitter.
No worries. We're going to bring all the culture champions together soon, and you guys can. Last week we interviewed Nikki Lustig from Twitter, so she might have something to say about this.
Can help me set up an account.
Exactly. Well, I don't have to have people. I can, you know, what we're going to do, besides give away your phone number in a second, is we're going to, at some point in the future, make Golby available to our audience in different formats, because part of what we want to do with this program and these podcasts is be able to have you guys out there be able to ask Golby some questions of your own and create a dialogue and between everybody in this community, so we can all be, you know, all culture champions in our own right. Mm-hmm. And like you're saying, it takes the understanding of your own environment. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, just to kind of be able to facilitate that dialogue where we're all helping each other.
Absolutely.
You know, people from other banks are learning from Golby. I'm sure Golby's learning from tons of other people. It's clear to bringing in things she's learned all over the place. So mm-hmm. I think that connection is something we're hoping to foster with everybody listening out there. So thank you so much for being here. Seriously. Actually, I'm here. Thanks so much for having me here to the BlackRock headquarters. It's really nice. In San Francisco here. It's a beautiful building, and everyone's been super lovely. So I really appreciate everything that you're doing here in BlackRock for having me down here. And so cool. I know Delivering Happiness appreciates it as well. So let's do this guided meditation. What do I do? Because am I supposed to call you on my phone right now?
No, you're fine. You're just like one of the people that comes and sits in person.
All right.
So I'll do with you what I do with the group. So this is the first time I've done it, I guess, recorded. We record all the sessions so people can listen to them wherever they are, whenever they want. But for a non-BlackRock person, Okay, so everyone would file into the room and we would want to turn down the light. So maybe I'll do that here.
That's nice.
Okay. So no more funny business. Okay. So you might want to adjust your seat height. So we're going to take a few minutes and just transition. And so it's about really finding a comfortable posture and a comfortable seat. So adjust your seat so that your feet are flat on the floor. And if you were a woman, I'd invite you to take off your heels. But the idea is really letting yourself feel rooted in this space. And then just start to notice the shape your body's taking. And you might want to move slightly away from the chair. So if you need lower back support, you can go ahead and stay rested and against the chair. But if not, you might want to move away. Because the idea is we want to have a relaxed and alert posture. We don't want to be slumped over. We're not sleeping. And so noticing the shape that your body's taking, just take a moment and maybe roll your shoulders back. And maybe tilt your chin slightly down so you create a little length in the back of your neck. And as they often say in a yoga asana class or a dance class, imagine a string at the top of your head just gently lifting you up. So creating a little bit of space between your vertebrae. So you want to have almost a dignified or a regal posture, a long, straight, strong spine. And if you don't know what to do with your hands, you can go ahead and put them on your legs or on your thighs. And if you're feeling a little bit more open, you can put them face up. And if you're feeling a little bit like you need more grounding, you can go ahead and put them face down. And if you're not sure, you can experiment. And then just notice how subtle changes in our body have an impact on how we feel. And so once you have a posture that you think you can hold, make the conscious choice to hold it. The more we can hold our body and our external environment still, the more aware we are of what's happening inside. And start to call to mind your intention or your motivation for coming today or for today's practice. What was it that got you away from your meeting or got you in early? Got you away from that spreadsheet? What was it that you wanted to experience today? Knowing that there's no right or wrong answer, but just having that in your mind. And then also seeing if there was one word to describe the mood that you're experiencing right now, what would it be? Again, there's no right or wrong. And if no one word comes to mind, you just might ask yourself, is it pleasant? Neutral, unpleasant. Again, just practicing the sense of awareness of what's real right now. And if you haven't yet taken a deep breath, go ahead and let your body take a deep breath. You might breathe in slowly. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then exhale slowly. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we'll do it again. Inhale slowly. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And exhale slowly. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then just let your breath return to whatever's natural and normal for you. Taking a few slow, deep breaths helps calm your body, tells your nervous system that it's safe and that you can relax. There's nowhere else that you need to be right now. And if there's anything distracting you, whether it's something that happened 5 minutes ago or 5 days ago or 5 years ago, or something that you're anticipating after today's practice in 20 minutes, 2 hours, 2 days, see if you can leave that in the hallway. And just let your mind be here with your body. Your body's in the present moment. Let your mind join your body. And with your breath as a natural rhythm, if it's shallow, it's shallow. If it's deep, it's deep. Neither one is right or wrong. Start to bring your awareness to your breath, using it as an anchor for the present moment. Your breath is always present. You can never breathe in the past. You can never breathe in the future. You can always breathe now. So letting your mind rest on your breath and noticing it from the moment it begins. Noticing the inhale. Noticing the pause between the inhale and the exhale. And then noticing the exhale, watching it, observing it. Just with gentle awareness. Not straining or forcing. And if it helps, you can rest your focus maybe on your chest or on your nose or nostrils, or some people like in between their eyebrows. But just watching your breath. With every inhale, creating space and possibility within your body. With every exhale, letting go of any tension or stress you might be holding in your mind or in your body. With every inhale, letting yourself be here, be in your body. With every exhale, releasing anything that's not serving you, anything that's not helping you. Sitting in the seat of awareness, behind all the thoughts. Our thoughts are often noise. Being present from that place of awareness that sees things as a neutral observer. And if you find your mind's wandered, it's no problem. Just notice that your mind's wandered. Lay the thought aside and come back and begin again. To watch and notice your breath. Enjoying the gentle rhythm. Knowing that your mind doesn't need to do anything right now. Your mind can rest. Your body knows exactly what to do. It has all the wisdom you need. It's been doing this every moment of your life. So letting your mind rest and just observing with easeful effort your breath. And if sounds or body sensations are distracting you, it's no problem. You could label them feeling or hearing and lay those aside as well. And come back. Watching your breath from the moment it begins. As it fills your body with space, all the way through the completion. And if your mind's wandered, it's no problem. Just notice that your mind's wandered. Try not to get caught in the content or the story. It's irrelevant right now. Just lay it aside, no matter how exciting of a thought, and come back just to being with your breath. Taking comfort in the fact there's nothing for you to do right now. You can let your body system relax and just be with your breath. And really gently without any rush or agenda, start to wiggle your fingers and toes. Might want to roll your shoulders or roll your neck. And then let the last thing to move be your eyes. Just let them gently float open. And come back to being here in this room.
Oh, seems like the lights are turning back on now.
We can keep them up.
Oh, no. Well, yeah, it's nice. That was really nice.
Thank
you. I can see why you have 1,300 people doing that. Even I, who was thinking, man, I hope this sound is recording, you know, so we don't lose this entire interview, which it looks like it is. You know, I was able to put that aside.
Good, yay.
And I felt really relaxed. And I really appreciate how you used the wow bell at the end there to get us back into... Oh, that wasn't the wow bell, was it?
But we can pretend.
Okay. Yeah, so thank you so much again.
You're welcome.
That was just really wonderful, and I really appreciate your insights, and I hope everyone out there does too. Something I think I'd like to have people do at the end of these podcasts is, you know, maybe you could have a sign off that you would say to people. Just, you know, I have my own, but I just want to give you a chance to say, come up on the spot, your own little sign off.
My own little sign off? Is that like a catchy phrase?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be catchy, though. I mean, I don't know if it's that catchy. Maybe we will start a little revolution with your phrase out there.
You know, one of the things I tell myself every day, and it's had a huge impact on my life, which I think will be my sign off, is today is the most important day of my life. It's the only day of my life. So that would be it. Today is the most important day of my life and yours.
Well, thank you, Golby. Look forward to talking to you again soon. And to everyone out there in the Delivering Happiness community, stay strong, stay happy.
Is that your sign off?
That was my sign.